WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Both albums that Wilner's produced feature different groupings of musicians selected by Wilner to interpret the work of one composer. For his album Amarchord Nina Rota, he invited several jazz musicians, including Jackie Byard, Carla Bley, and Mujal Richard Abrams, to interpret the film scores written by Nina Rota for Federico Fellini. For Wilner's new album, That's the Way I Feel Now, he selected several jazz and rock musicians to perform the compositions of Thelonious Monk. Every composition is performed by a different band. Some of the musicians who participated in this project include jazz musicians Steve Lacy, Gil Evans, Charlie Rouse, Carla Bley, and Elvin Jones. Rock performers include Donald Fagen of Steely Dan, Todd Rundgren, Joe Jackson, Peter Frampton, and the bands NRBQ, Was Not Was, and Shockabilly. This Monk tribute is on the A&M record label, and Hal Wilner, by the way, grew up in Philadelphia. Welcome back to Philadelphia, and welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Before we hear some of the music that you've produced, how did you first get this idea of having theme records where you would invite the musicians to interpret the work of one composer?
Well, it started with Nina Rota. After he passed away, I wanted to do a tribute album to him. And I guess I heard different compositions done by different artists in my head. The theme from 8 1/2 I thought was perfect for Carla Bley. And I heard La Strada and Amarchord, which would be great for solo piano. So I decided just to ask different arrangers to do them, and it worked out.
Do you like Fellini's movies, or is it mostly the music that sticks in your mind?
Well, originally it was Fellini's films. I'm a very big fan. And while researching Rota, I did find out he was a great composer for other films and for his own classical works. I mean, his music for Visconti's films was wonderful, and the Godfather movies, even though those songs are perhaps overplayed, it is good music, and a Romeo and Juliet theme. So I found out about him later.
How'd you think of which composers, musicians, that is, would make sense playing the music of Rota?
Well, obviously, it's very personal, so the musicians were musicians that I liked and felt can pull it off.
Were they shocked when you called?
Half of them didn't know Rota, and half of them did. But I don't think anyone was shocked. I think Mujal Richard Abrams didn't know why I wanted him. A few instances like that. But with Debbie Harry and Chris Stein and Carlo Bley and Jackie Byard, they were fine.
Well, I want to play Jackie Byard's version of La Strada, of the Nina Rota theme for La Strada. Can you talk about why you chose Byard to do that selection?
He was always one of my favorite piano players. And I'm not exactly sure. I was just going through material. So I gave him three themes. One was Amarchord, one was La Strada, and the other was Orchestra Rehearsal, which he chose not to do. And it just worked out great.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is Jackie Byard playing Nina Rota's theme from La Strada, from the album Amarchord Nina Rota, produced by my guest, Hal Wilner.
Thank you.
Jackie Byard playing the theme from Federico Fellini's film La Strada. The theme was written by Nino Rota. And my guest is Hal Wilner, who produced the album that that selection is featured on. The album is called Amarcord Nino Rota, and it features several musicians interpreting Rota's work. Did Fellini give you any support for the project?
Oh, a lot. Rota just passed away when he found out about it. And he just helped us in every way possible as far as getting music. I don't think he understood the jazz interpretations. In Rome especially, jazz is not a big thing. So I remember going to his office to play him the album. And he didn't have any sort of stereo equipment in the office. And I had a little Sony Walkman, which he put on, which it was a bizarre sight, to sitting across from Fellini with a Sony Walkman on. And any time it would get into an improvisational thing, he wouldn't look puzzled. But I think he appreciated what we did. We did expose Rota's music to a new audience.
How were you able to reach Fellini? Was he hard to get hold of?
No, you could find out his address pretty easily. And he supposedly reads every letter he gets and answers the ones that he wants to. So, I mean, I wrote him and he just sent me a letter back and gave me his phone number.
The Nino Rota record was produced on a small record label, Hannibal Records.
Yeah, well, like The Monk, I started it myself and then a label came along and put it out for me.
How did... Well, before we talk about how you got hooked up with A&M and how that experience compares with the smaller record label experience, maybe you can tell us why you wanted to do the Tribute to Monk album.
Well, I had always been a fan of Monk's since I was 13 or 14 years old. And back then, I was a rock and roll listener. And I was always aware of other rock and roll listeners who were into Monk, but never became jazz musicians. His music relates to rock and roll in a certain way. So after Monk passed away, I went to his memorial service, and I just thought in the back of my head, you know, why aren't there any non-jazz performers here? And then I didn't think much about it afterwards. And then there were a series of tribute concerts given to Monk that summer after he died, and I went to a huge one at Carnegie Hall, and it was just filled with all the obvious people. And I was wondering why NRBQ wasn't there. They're very well-known fans of Monk. This rock and roll band that will always play a Monk tune in concert. People like Donald Fagen always talk about Monk in interviews. And yet it was just all the same people that you would, you know, see everywhere. And when Oscar Peterson came on stage is when I reacted, because I like Oscar Peterson, but him and Monk did not like each other. It's very well-known. Peterson used to put Monk down all the time in his early days. And Monk, later on, started to put Peterson down, and what he was doing at this concert was bizarre. So, having had already done the Nino Rota album, I set out thinking I would do the same kind of thing for Monk, using all different types of musicians.
You have a mix of jazz and rock musicians. Mm-hmm. Did you expect both audiences to be interested in the record? Because I think a lot of rock listeners aren't much interested in jazz composers or jazz musicians.
Well, I was.
Jazz musicians might feel uncomfortable by rock performers interpreting Monk's music.
Well, I guess that was in the back of my head, but I didn't let that bother me at all. It is coming out a little differently than I thought. I thought when we made the record that a lot of fans of Todd Rundgren's and Donald Fagen's and Joe Jackson's would be picking up the record and hearing Steve Lacy for the first time and then becoming jazz fans. But it seems to be more turning out the other way, where a lot of jazz fans are buying the record and hearing Donald Fagen and NRBQ and Peter Frampton, believe it or not, and saying, hey, these guys can play.
Let's hear one of the selections that you did, and this is an example of one rock and one jazz musician collaborating on a piece. And let me ask you to describe why you wanted to have alto saxophonist Gary Window and synthesizer player Todd Rundgren collaborate together.
Well, I had produced an album with Gary Window a few years ago called Dog Face. And Gary lives up in Bearsville, where Todd lives, and Carla Blaine, NRBQ, and all those people. And he told Todd about the track, or actually not the track, about the album, and he expressed interest in doing something. And I always heard 4-in-1 being played on synthesizers, because it's got a line that could be played on a sequencer that goes blah-blah-blah-blah. And so I said, well, why don't you do that cut? And Todd was really into it, and Gary was. So we went up there to Todd's studio one day, and we just did it.
Okay, let's hear it. This is 4-in-1, with Todd Rundgren on synthesizer and Gary Windo alto saxophone from the album That's the Way I Feel Now, a tribute to Thelonious Monk, produced by my guest Hal Wilner. Alto saxophonist Gary Windo with Todd Rundgren on synthesizer, playing Thelonious Monk's 4-in-1 from the album That's the Way I Feel Now, produced by my guest Hal Wilner. One of the people who gets to play like three or four tracks on your record is soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy, who spends most of his time in Europe. I know he has an album of Thelonious Monk compositions.
Well, for years, that's all he played.
Tell us about his affiliation with Monk and how you located him.
Well, he played with Monk's band for 6 months. Unfortunately, that band was never recorded. That was the one with Charlie Rouse and Frankie Dunlap. But somehow or another, Lacy was never recorded when he was with them. But he moved to France years ago and for years had a band that played nothing but Monk's music, and in recent years started doing other things. I had worked with him on the Nina Rota album. He played Roma. And he's one of my favorite musicians of all time. He's just wonderful. And he was one of the musicians that I talked to when I first started the Monk album about whether he approves of what I'm doing using rock musicians to play jazz. And he was very supportive and wanted to be a part of it. So we sat down and came up with the idea of him doing duets, which would bring fresh interpretations as far as he was concerned. I mean, approach it differently than he ever has. So we came up with all the musicians that he's duetting with, which are Charlie Rouse, Elvin Jones, and Gil Evans.
Was he in America at the time?
Yeah. Well, we flew him in to do this, but he was on a small tour, and we got together for an evening.
Why don't we hear one of those duets? We're going to hear Evidence, in which he duets with drummer Elvin Jones. Do you want to say anything about this collaboration?
Well, it was a dream for me. I was a kid when I first heard Elvin Jones with John Coltrane, and it was always a dream to record him. And, you know, Steve wanted to do something with Elvin, and he immediately agreed. And it's nothing more to say, really. It's just a great performance.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy and drummer Elvin Jones playing Thelonious Monk's Evidence. With soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy with drummer Elvin Jones playing Evidence from the album That's the Way I Feel Now, which was produced by my guest Hal Wilner. It's a tribute to the late Thelonious Monk, and it features jazz and rock musicians who were selected by Hal Wilner and invited to participate. Did anyone turn you down?
Oh, yes. I guess I shouldn't say who.
But I'll come and sue everybody,
certain,
of course.
Well, actually, no rock musician that we approached turned us down. There are a few who I felt their managers didn't give them the information, so that would be unfair to mention them. There are certain jazz artists which ask for a lot of money, which we couldn't afford. But the album was already filled up. There are some people who were going to be on it who didn't have time. Thomas Dolby was going to do a track, so he'll be on the next album.
The first album that you did was on an independent record label, mm-hmm. and this one is affiliated with A&M Records. What's the difference to you as a producer between having distribution from, you know, a major label and doing an independent one?
Well, the difference is, one, you get paid, because independent labels don't have the power to collect, okay? So they don't have the records in all the stores. So you can walk into any record store and see your album if it's on a major label. And that's the major thing.
How did you hook up with them?
Well, Gil Friesen and Jeff Gold at A&M were fans of the Rota album. And via Joe Jackson, they knew about this record. I recorded four tracks before I had a deal. Did Joe Jackson's track, Donald Fagen and Steve Kahn's track, Peter Frampton and Chris Spedding's and NRBQ's. So I went around with a tape. And A&M heard the tape and immediately wanted the album. There were a few other labels that wanted it, but their reaction was so positive that I knew that was the place to go.
Saturday Night Live, where you've worked, has a lot of sketches about business dealings in the record world that are really pretty funny. Do you think the record world turns out to really be like that?
It's worse. They seem to go more after the kids that buy these things and the viewers of MTV than the actual corporate heads. So I guess the industry is pretty close to Spinal Tap.
Uh-huh. One of the compositions on the record that takes the most liberties with the original composition is the recording of Shuffle Boyle.
Well, if you think so. It really doesn't, because they play the melody. That's the interesting thing. Everyone who I played this record for, like Randy Weston and so forth, I mean, at first, you know, it's taken a little aback, but they played it in tunes correctly. I mean, the melody is there. I mean, you might not hear it right off because it's played on duck calls. But, I mean, they're playing the tunes.
Why don't you describe the musicians who you got together for this?
Well, on this track, there's a guy named John Zorn, who's my favorite of the whole new music scene, which I guess Laurie Anderson is the most popular person from. And he is just wonderful. I mean, he plays mostly game calls. And he assembled some of the other top musicians from that scene, Arto Lindsay, Wayne Horvitz, and Emmy Miller. And both of us came up with the track Shuffle Boyle for him to do.
How come?
I don't know. We both heard that melody in our heads for his instruments.
For his duck calls and stuff.
Yeah. But it was wonderful to work with him. The way we did the track was they did the basic track first, then they improvised over it, and then we took out the rhythm section before we mixed it. So actually it's just their solos without the rhythm section during the middle.
Anyone get upset hearing this?
No, everyone laughs. It's a very funny tune. I mean, you can't get upset at any of this 4-in-1. I mean, they're playing the tunes right, as I said, and the humor is there. Monk's music was very humorous. I think Monk would have loved this track.
Okay,
and 4-in-1.
Let's hear it. This is Shuffle Boyle. was a band led by John Zorn, who was playing the duck calls on it, and that was Thelonious Monk's Shuffle Boyle from the album That's the Way I Feel Now, a tribute to Thelonious Monk, produced by my guest, Hal Wilner. You've recorded rock and jazz musicians for both of your records, the Nino Rota and the Thelonious Monk. Do they both have different approaches to recording, have different expectations of what equipment they're going to find in the recording studio and how long they'll end up spending there?
Well, of course, the rock musicians spend more time on their tracks because of the instruments that they use. Donald Fagen's track with Steve Kahn took about 20 to 30 hours in the studio to record. And the longest it took to do any of the jazz-type pieces was Carla Blaze, which took one whole night. But besides that, they were all done in basically an hour.
Another aspect of your work that we haven't discussed yet is your work as music coordinator for Saturday Night Live.
Mm.
How did you first hook up with them?
They hooked up with me, actually. When they changed regimes after Lorne Michaels left, they hired a new music director and producer who knew about me. I was running around Europe at the time, but they called and, you know, offered the job, and it's nothing like a job, so I came back to do it, and I've been there for 4 years, and that might be it, but...
What's the job description of the music coordinator?
Well, it's different for every show. For this show, it's basically I would get scripts on Wednesday night, and I would score the sketches using music that has already been recorded, mostly from other soundtracks and certain classical records. Put them on carts and would cue them in live on air, which can give you ulcers. But there's a great feeling at 1 o'clock when it's all over. It's like some sketches would have 12 to 15 music cues in it, and you would be on TV live, and we would never get to rehearse the music before dress rehearsal. So if something was wrong, you had an hour to fix it between dress and air.
What's an example of a sketch with a lot of music that you had to choose? Because I'm sure a lot of our listeners will remember the sketch.
Oh, well, this past season, I guess, on the John Candy show, the takeoff on the Children of the Damned, they did with the Little Rascals.
And what music did you choose?
Oh, we used music from four different films, from Maniac, some stuff from Dr. Strangelove, from The Howling, some Stravinsky music.
Is this all from your collection?
Well, NBC has one of the great music libraries in the country. They have over 50,000 records. So we use that, my collection, and we use Colony Records, which is a record store in New York that's open all night.
How do you know what the music from, Maniac or what The Howling sounds like? I mean, who walks out of there remembering the incidental music from horror movies that you've seen once?
But doing that kind of job, you buy a lot of soundtrack records. So usually every week during that show, I'll go and pick up all the new soundtrack albums and listen to them. I mean, you know, if you have a horror sketch and you go to a record store, you'll get all the horror soundtrack records and be able to pick it out. The only thing that's difficult about it is you have 2 days to put it together. I mean, the show is on Saturday, and you first get the scripts Wednesday night. So there is a time pressure.
Was there ever a time when the wrong record came on?
Absolutely. but usually do have a rehearsal. It's just that I have to cue the music through an engineer. So sometimes it gets confusing. For example, if an actor forgets his lines, and after an actor says, "Pass the pickles," you're supposed to hit a sting. If he doesn't say the line, then you get confused. Biggest memory of one of those things is when David Carradine hosted the show. He totally forgot what he was doing in a sketch live. So we just threw in any music cue we could find right there because we got totally lost. We had 15 cues in that sketch, and after the fourth one, he totally forgot his lines. That was actually Eddie Murphy's first year, and he pulled the sketch off. He dragged David around the stage and did the sketch for him. I mean, I heard that does happen once in a while. Must be. I mean, if it's hard on us, imagine what it would be like to be out in front of the camera on live TV.
What's the point of playing a music cue if somebody's forgotten their lines? What does that do?
Well, you don't really think about that. You're live. You're panicking. So you might as well put it in just to give the sketch a bottom so there's no blank space. But with that sketch in particular, we just threw on Q6, which was a big sting, which came on for no reason at all. So since then, there hasn't been too many mistakes. There's been a few now and then.
I guess people behind the scenes see flaws in the show that viewers at home would never notice.
Yeah. Mostly there's a director, Dave Wilson, who's there in the room, and you make a mistake and you get screamed at on air. But yeah, people at home don't really see these things, unless it's major.
Is it a friendly, cooperative atmosphere there?
No. Sometimes it is. And as I said, I've been there 4 years, and I don't know if I can do another one.
What's the pressure like from the people, not just the deadlines and the live nature of the show?
Well, for the job that I do, the only pressure I get sometimes is from the director. If by any chance we play music during dress rehearsal for the first time and he doesn't like it, and we have an hour to fix it, you know, that's pressure. And the fact that you're doing this live on air is always a pressure. But as I said, the feeling at 1 o'clock when the show is over is a feeling of relief, which I can't really describe.
Is there a big staff party too afterwards?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where would you hold it?
They have it at different places every week. I mean, it's a great job to have had. I just don't know if I can do it again. There could never be a harder job.
What are your projects that you plan to do as follow-ups to the Rota and the Monk records?
Well, we're doing a Rota Volume 2, which will have music from a lot of the other films that Rota composed for, such as The Godfather, Rocco and His Brothers, Romeo and Juliet, and some obscure Italian films. And we are going to do a Kurt Weill tribute, which will feature some people from this album, including Carla Bley and Todd Rundgren and Joe Jackson, and also involved will be David Byrne and Van Dyke Parks, which we hope to start in November. And I have a rock and roll record that I did with Hunter Thompson and Ralph Steadman. One song.
Do they perform?
Yeah. It's a song that they wrote with Maureen Dean of John Dean. It's called Those Weird and Twisted Nights.
Want to explain the connection between Maureen Dean and Hunter Thompson?
Well, they just know each other. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly how this came about, except they happened to be in the same hotel, and one night they just wrote this song together about 4 or 5 years ago when they were making the film Where the Buffalo Roam. And I know Steadman pretty well, so he played me the song one day, and I just said, let's make a record of this. So we did, and it'll probably be out in the fall sometime.
Okay, well, good luck with those projects. And I want to be able to play one more record from the Monk album. We're going to hear a duet between Charlie Rouse and Steve Lacy. How did you get them together for this?
Well, they played together with Monk sometime in the 60s. And when Steve was in town, he wanted to do a duet of Ask Me Now, which is a very beautiful song. And he wanted to do it as a duet because he used to play it by himself on the Williamsburg Bridge. He used to go out there at night and play. And we called Charlie, and he said, sure. So they rehearsed it for a few hours, and we got it on the second take, and it's just one of my favorite things I ever recorded. It's very emotional, and everyone in the control room was crying when they were in the middle of the take. It's just wonderful.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for visiting with us. Thanks
thank
for
you.
Being here.